The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society, celebrating more than a half century of promoting awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org. This podcast is brought to you through the generous financial support of the Tongyang Group. In the areas of financial services and manufacturing, the companies of the Tongyang Group harness the passion and creativity of 12,000 employees worldwide to better serve their clients. The Tongyang Group, a global partner for Korean business. On May 26, 2011, Harvard University's Ezra Vogel spoke to the Korea Society about the monumental new political history he co-edited, The Park Chung-hee Era, The Transformation of South Korea. The discussion was moderated by Charles Armstrong, the Korea Foundation Professor of Korean Studies in the Social Sciences and Director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University in the city of New York.
Thank you, Steve. Thank all of you for coming tonight. I have been listed somewhere on the Korea Society website as the moderator of this event. I'm not sure quite what that means, but I just wanted to say a couple of words of introduction before passing the baton over to Ezra. I was quite peripherally involved with this project, which began quite a few years ago in a conference in Seoul. And at the time, it was already quite striking how important this was clearly going to be. It is by far the best book, I think, on the Park era, and the first to really cover all dimensions of this very significant period in Korean history, the economic, political, cultural, and so forth. It's not a small book. It's quite a hefty tome, but I think a very comprehensive and important book. Ezra will talk more about the project and a particular aspect of this that he's involved with. Before then, I'll make a few remarks of my own.
I very much appreciate the opportunity to be with you this evening. And when I was asked to do this, I said it was on the understanding that we get a Korean specialist like Charles Armstrong to join and to make a presentation also, because I'm not a Korean specialist. I was brought in as a comparativist who works on China and Japan, who's interested in Korea, but not as a Korean specialist. About 13 years ago, Kim Byung-guk, whom I think probably all of you know, who had been a student of mine, came to me and said, would you help me edit a collection of articles on the Park Chung-hee era? And at first I said no, but then he persisted. And his argument was this, that the Park Chung-hee era is so controversial, it's very difficult to put it into perspective. Park Chung-hee was such a cruel person, with the CIA, with his clamping down on the intellectuals, with his efforts to control by intimidation, by his Yushin Constitution, which ended any hope of real democratic politics during his era. And on the other hand, he accomplished a great deal. And since intellectuals had suffered under him, it was very hard to get the intellectual distance. And Byung-guk thought that if we had some foreigners involved in this, to do comparative studies, we might be able to get a little more intellectual distance. Well, one thing that Byung-guk and I shared was the conviction that too many people were approaching these studies of area studies in a theoretical perspective without understanding really the political involvement of what was really going on. And that we felt what was really needed was to get into the politics. Byung-guk told me that there were something like 800 students in Korea who had studied political science as graduate students in the United States, an extraordinary number. And within that group, we would try to select some of the best to do various studies. when we had the first conference 13 years ago, there were three volumes of papers. And we tried to narrow this down and to try to select the best and the ones that were the most logical and the best informed and also the best written. We confronted the problem that even though Korean graduate students had learned English, that it wasn't often up to the editorial standards of the American academic reader. And one of the things we did, we got a woman named Elizabeth Gilbert, the Harvard University Press, to go over the documents very carefully so that they would be very accurate and read like English documents. And I think we've been very successful in that. We started this process 13 years ago. I think the main problem, frankly, is that Byung-guk was so busy and doing so many things that he didn't give it the time in the early years it was needed to complete the job. And by way of procrastination, we've had the good fortune now to have this published in the 50th anniversary of Park Chung-hee. So sweet are the uses of procrastination that occasionally they come out pretty well. We're sorry it's taken that long, but in a way it's a very good year to examine the 50 years and to think about the Park Chung-hee in the 50th year. I thought I would talk a little bit about my own personal perspective on this, because I've spent the last 10 years working on Deng Xiaoping, and Deng Xiaoping, like Park Chung-hee, was a soldier who became the head of a country, ran it in a very authoritarian way, and made a breakthrough in his country that brought modernization, and that has established a pattern that still has a big impact on the country. And although I wrote an essay on that, the essay I wrote for this volume was actually written probably 10 years or so ago. And I've continued to work, and I have more things to say about Deng. So I thought I would make a few more comments about the comparison between Deng and Park, because I think it does help understand a kind of perspective on what made for that era. One thing, of course, was that Deng was a nationalist who was not compromised by having worked closely with another foreign country. When he dealt with the Soviet Union, he was very clear that he was speaking as a Chinese against the Soviet Union. Park Chung-hee was compromised, of course, by having worked so closely with the Japanese, especially in Manchuria. In addition, Park Chung-hee, of course, came to power by way of a coup, so he never had the legitimacy that Deng did. And Deng also had so much more to build on. The institutions were partially in place. In the case of Park Chung-hee, Syngman Rhee and Chang Myon had never really built up the institutions that would pave the way for modernization. And the kind of people, therefore, that Park Chung-hee could rely on were a combination between military, who had not had much experience in the civilian economy, people he'd worked very closely with who were disciplined, who could go into other kinds of work, and a tiny number of bureaucrats who had mostly been trained under the Japanese and were understood a great deal. Although they were in lower positions in the Japanese bureaucracy, they could begin to learn and to stretch. Deng Xiaoping, in contrast, could rely on people who came from the military to civilian life much earlier. After 1949, a lot of the people who led economic work in China were people who had been generals, Li Xianyan, for example, Li Fuchun. All these people had been very active in the military, Chen Yi, who went into foreign policy, but they had come in much earlier. So that by the time Deng came to power, these people had already had an opportunity for over 20 years. What Deng dealt with, of course, was a group of senior party leaders who had had political experience. In the case of Park Chung-hee, he didn't really have people who had had political experience in the same kind of way. And the group, the allies that Deng had, were these senior officials who had been criticized during the Cultural Revolution, who were out of office, but gave him a kind of special support against those who had risen during the Cultural Revolution at the expense of these senior officials. So in contrast to Pak Chung-hee, who identified with the Kyongsan people and the Changchun people, and against some of the Northerners, had a strong base in those areas, Deng Xiaoping had a much broader base of senior officials who had worked in all kinds of areas. Also, Deng had a much broader, a much larger scale economic base to build on. So with that huge base to build on, they could let in foreign companies without worrying that they might take over the country. They could let in companies in one part of the country with the hope that even if they let in foreign companies, that they would be able to control and that wouldn't dominate their economy. On the case of South Korea, because the Japanese companies were so strong and had so much impact, South Korea, learning from the Japanese, felt that they had to keep out foreign companies, or if they came in, they would dominate the country. And so they were learning the Japanese pattern of trying to build up their own industries and their own service sectors without allowing the foreign countries to have a strong foothold. And in the case of South Korea, it was even more important because so many of the companies they learned from were the Japanese companies. In the case of China, they could start with they started with an economy that was fairly large scale, and they could let in companies they let the economy grow in the service sector that was out of the planned sector. So they already had a large planned economy. And so what really started the growth was allowing individual enterprises to grow outside of those large companies. In the case of Pak Chung-hee, he had to establish the Economic Planning Board and begin to build companies from scratch. The way I read the Jaibols is that they started with small companies in one sector, and once they succeeded in one sector, then Pak Chung-hee would select people in other sectors. He would select people who had succeeded in one sector and help them grow in other sectors. What Deng did, in contrast, he had such a huge operation, is that he really began to give more autonomy to individual companies that grew up in the countryside and also in the towns and villages. Because Deng allowed this new growth outside the planned economy, the planned economy could stay roughly the same size and the growth would take place outside. In the case of Pak Chung-hee, of course, what he wanted to do is build up the larger companies and the bigger sectors. They both learned, of course, from Japan, and just as Pohang is a spitting image of a Japanese steel plant. One of the things I had an opportunity to do when I was studying Japan was visit a number of the large steel plants. And so when I visited Pohang, I could see the leggings and everything about the operation was exactly as the Japanese steel company. The Chinese already had steel companies. But the breakthrough came from doing exactly the same thing of learning from the Japanese because they had the largest integrated steel mills. So the big Baoshan steel plant that went up outside of Shanghai was a spitting image of Kimitsu. And when Deng Xiaoping had gone to Japan in 78, he saw that plant. And so they went back and brought it in. I think the South Koreans had a much more difficult complex with the Japanese than the Chinese did, although it's very similar. And the Koreans had worked with him so closely, and they were so afraid of domination. But they knew the Japanese language. They could see Japanese companies, and they really knew them intimately. Deng Xiaoping had a similar problem that Park Chung-hee did in trying to get the Chinese to accept the Japanese. Just as the Koreans were very upset at Japan, so were the Chinese. And so when Park Chung-hee made the big step in 1965 to normalize relations with Japan, that was a huge blow. Deng Xiaoping had much more political experience. So what he could do, he arranged a trip to Japan in 1978. He traveled and then arranged that films of that trip would be available in China when he got back. And he could show the Chinese people that they were being greeted in a very friendly fashion by the Japanese. And also it could show the Chinese what a advanced country that Japan was and how far they were behind. So he developed a closeness to Japan, and in the 1980s he even introduced Japanese literature and Japanese movies that became very popular in China during that decade. It was only after the Tiananmen incident in 1989 when Chinese leaders were worried about the patriotism of their citizens and started a patriotic education campaign that led to very anti-Japanese propaganda, that they really became, on a large public scale, openly anti-Japanese. But so both these places, South Korea and China, had to deal with that problem of letting their public accept this kind of aid. South Korea, of course, had to worry much more about domination by Japan because they were so much bigger and so much stronger. China could let in Japanese companies in certain localities and not worry that it would take over the whole country. A lot of South Koreans look at the big buildup of industry along the southeast coast as a prejudice that Park Chung-hee had because he was from the Gyeongsangdo area and that he was prejudiced against Chola. But Deng Xiaoping was from Inner China, but he built up his industry on China's southeast coast. There was a certain logic to the location in the southeast coast because that made it easier for the ship travel for imports and exports across the Pacific, which is, of course, with American growth and American involvement, the very big area. And another area that was very important for building was scientific advancement. And China, already in 1978, realized that they had to send many people to the United States to study. One of the big differences was in the role of military technology and military advance. Because the American military was so heavily involved in South Korea, a lot of the technology was a spin-off from the military. So there were people like Park Chung-hee, who, being in the military, already had a lot of technical training, which they could use in the civilian economy. In the case of China, Deng Xiaoping felt the military was so far behind, and that in order to really begin to modernize, they had to concentrate first on the civilian sector. And because even with the Cold War, the United States was not prepared to supply the technology, China could not get much technology through the military. It came overwhelmingly from the civilian area. And Deng Xiaoping therefore decided to build up the civilian area before he developed the military. Because Park Chung-hee was so worried about the continued danger of invasion from the North and of conflict with the North, and particularly after Nixon's Guam Doctrine of 1975, with the threat that the United States might pull out of the peninsula, there was real concern that they had to move and develop heavy industry very fast, and they therefore concentrated on very heavy industry. In the case of Deng Xiaoping, on the contrary, he, in 1979, when he first came to power, was very worried that the Soviets and the Vietnamese were going to surround. And he, therefore, decided to demonstrate China's determination by invading Vietnam. And he did so in the spring of 1979. But once that was over, he was no longer really worried about foreign invasion. So Deng Xiaoping could therefore begin to concentrate in a more relaxed way on civilian industry, and they could rely on consumer industry to spur the economy and let it develop. In the case of Park Chung-hee, because he was so worried about the danger of invasion from the north, because he could see what happened in Manchuria, where World War II success depended so much on heavy industry and having that industrial base, he was determined to build up the heavy and chemical industry, as Japan had done, to build a base in case of continued danger from North Korea. Whereas Deng Xiaoping was able to concentrate on the civilian economy to tell the military people to wait with the development of modern technology. And it wasn't until two decades later, in the late 1990s, when the military was allowed to modernize in the same kind of way. Also, Park Chung-hee, because he had to cooperate and was so with the United States, despite his ambivalence, felt it necessary to send troops to the Vietnam. But China had never been an ally, and even during the Cold War, the United States and China cooperated, but they were not allies in the same way. And so this meant both that the United States did not supply as much technology, and it meant also that the local people had to, they could develop the civilian economy, and China could cooperate with their local consumer industry as a way of really boosting the economy. Well, perhaps that's enough details to get the discussion started, but I think it's interesting to me that the very end of the Deng and the Park Chung-hee era, they both ran into problems for similar reasons. At the end of the Park Chung-hee era, of course, they were concerned about inflation, and it was in that kind of context it was so much new anti-Park sentiment, and it was that was the context in which he was shot by the director of the KCIA. In the case of the Tiananmen incident in 1989, the context of that was also from inflation. And the reason that became such a big incident is that the people were so frightened of inflation after 1988, the freeing of prices, that they demonstrated on the streets, and the popular public in Beijing supported the students. So the bottom line was that the real crises at the very end of both their periods came from the fear of inflation. It wasn't so much that the populace was concerned about democracy, wasn't the thing that led to this most severe problems. Of course, people wanted democracy in both places, but the real crisis came from worry about the pocketbook, and I think the base of popularity of both people also came from the economic progress. Thank you very much.
I wanted to say a few things more about the book and then make a couple of brief comments on two different areas of inquiry that the book, I think, doesn't fully address. And I will get to those in a moment. First, about the book, it is certainly a very rich and detailed exploration of the Park Chung-hee period, but it is by no means a hagiography of Park the Man or a glorification of that period. It gives all of the complexity and the negative aspects of the Pakchungi period, I think, quite fairly. And we see the sometimes ruthless use of the coercive apparatus of the state very dramatically in a number of places. I wanted to point out a few things that I found really striking in reading the different chapters of the book, which brought home to me the complexity which I think I had not fully realized about the period, which is often seen, whatever side you're on in the debates in Korea, in sort of black and white, either or terms. For example, the role of intellectuals, I thought, was covered very nicely in the book. And there is a tendency to see the Pak period as being divided between the state on the one hand, the authoritarian state, versus the intellectuals as the opposition. But of course, that's not necessarily the case. There were intellectuals who strongly supported Pak. There were those who were more neutral about his rule. There were those who sort of waited to see what would happen. There were, of course, intellectuals who remain consistently opposed to the authoritarian regime as well. And so to understand Korea today, I think, which for a long time had been portrayed in American society as having undergone this long period of authoritarian rule, which then had been thoroughly rejected, you know, we see the roots of contemporary Korea in its various aspects going back to this period of time. A second aspect which I found striking was the discussion of the Jaya, or the opposition, and the multiple origins of and multiple perspectives of different opposition forces, and how that evolved within the political structure over time. Again, often seen in sort of black and white terms as Pak versus the Jaya versus the opposition political structures, but much more complex and fluid than that stereotype. A third is regionalism. Regionalism, as I'm sure most of us are very familiar with, is seen as a endemic characteristic of Korean politics, and that division is often attributed to Pak. But one of the authors, I forget who, points out that regionalism really comes, or at least the persistent Cholla region opposition to the state is more a product of Chun Doo-hwan than Pak Chung-hee. And the Cholla people are actually much more divided about their view of Pak Chung-hee than they were of his successor. And so the really hard regionalism of South Korean politics is it cannot be entirely attributed to Pak's regime, but is to a great extent a product of what comes after, although his policy certainly did contribute ultimately to that. And the writing, there are several chapters that discuss the economy and especially the chaebol, the conglomerates, which I thought were really rich and fascinating, particularly the chapter on POSCO, which I had never seen a full study of POSCO before, which is a very important a company that you allude to when you mention Pohang. And a final element, there's a whole section in the book on comparisons, which I also thought was fascinating. Some of the usual comparisons you would expect, the Pak Chung-hee, South Korea compared to Japan and Taiwan, for example. Your own chapter, which is a little bit more surprising, comparing Pak to Deng Xiaoping, Lee Kuan Yew, and Kemal Ataturk, of all people. Jorge Dominguez's chapter on, I believe it's his chapter on Latin American
countries. Yes, yes. Yes.
Looking at Brazil and Mexico and Chile, which is, the chapter's provocative title is The Perfect Dictatorship, which is certainly something to think about in comparison to Latin America especially. And the chapter on comparing negatively, you know, Pak Chung-hee's South Korea, or South Korea is seen as a great success, but what about the might-have-beens, what about the failures? And one in particular that stands out, which is explored very well in the book, is the Philippines under Ferdinand Marcos. Another one which I think would be an obvious comparison, which is not talked about very much, surprisingly, is South Vietnam. In a certain sense, and this also can explore the question of American policy in East Asia. And in a certain sense, I think the United States, by the late 60s, was trying to find South Vietnam's Pak Chung-hee and never succeeded in doing so. But one comparison that isn't explored, which I want to talk about for a few minutes, is the comparison to South Korea and North Korea and of the leaders of the two countries this time that we explore in this book, Pak Chung-hee and Kim Il-sung. Gregory Henderson once edited a book called Divided Nations in a Divided World, which is one of the very few broadly global comparisons of the issue of divided nations. And the division of Korea during the Cold War seemed to perfectly reflect this geopolitical division. And of course, South and North Korea represented a kind of, in a microcosm, the competition between these two opposing systems. And once you looked closely at North and South Korea, you could see a number of interesting similarities. Divided countries, parts of a divided nation, devastated by war, with strong authoritarian leaders, and attempting to industrialize as quickly as possible. North Korea actually succeeding in this a little bit earlier than South Korea. Indeed, in the late 1950s, North Korea, by some estimates, had the highest rates of industrial growth in the world. And some people, at least North Korea's sympathizers, were referring to North Korea at that time as the economic miracle of the Far East, just as others would talk about South Korea as the economic miracle of Asia 10 or 20 years later. Even in terms of the political system, particularly in the period of what we might call high authoritarianism in the 1970s under Park Chung-hee, Park Chung-hee's move toward a more explicitly dictatorial system with the Yushin Constitution 1972 created a situation in which North and South Korea probably looked more like each other than at any time before or since, and in both of them even established new constitutions in the same year. 1972, at the same time in which, of course, they also engaged in interaction with each other for the first time directly since the Korean War had ended. And the individuals themselves, Park Chung-hee and Kim Il-sung, show some striking similarities. Two sons of the soil coming from very impoverished backgrounds in peripheral areas of Korea, having lived through the Japanese colonial period, both having fought in foreign armies, actually, outside of Korea, Park for the Japanese, Kim in the Chinese Communist Army, and then in the Soviet Army at the end of World War II. Both returned to Korea with an unswerving mission in their minds to make their country modern and great. There were differences between the two, of course, that were also very striking. The austere, rather introverted Confucian Park versus the much more extroverted and gregarious Kim Il-sung. And Kim, of course, began his rule much earlier. He was the initial leader of North Korea. Park came to power after a coup, which the timing of this is really perfect. It's almost exactly 50 years ago this month. That the coup took place. And even in the point of greatest similarity in the 1970s, North Korea was at a different point, one of much more self-confidence, having a history of what they saw of a successful development behind them, but we can see in retrospect already beginning to decline. The differences, of course, were also equally, if not more important. Different types of political economies. South Korea's economy was never centrally planned. Although it did have economic plans, multi-year economic plans, it was always a cooperation, a collusion of business and government rather than the business being controlled by the state. Different types of political systems. Even if South Korea did move toward a one-man dictatorship in the 1970s, there was always a space for opposition, however constrained. There was always an ideal somewhere of a liberal democracy upon which South Korea was founded, and none of that existed in North Korea. There was never the space within North Korea for any kind of serious, widespread political opposition, only certain kinds of disputes at the center of power, and even that was essentially dissipated after the mid-1960s. And, of course, the external environment between North and South Korea was vastly different, although in some ways symmetrical. One could see the two great powers on the one side, Soviet Union and China backing North Korea, faced in a kind of mirror image of the United States and Japan supporting the South. But of course, Japan and the United States were never rivals the way that Soviet Union and China were. Japan was always a subordinate player to the United States. The United States loomed extremely large as the hegemonic power in Korea, as the Soviet Union and China never did after the 1950s. Park Chung-hee was never able to maneuver between Japan and the United States the way Kim Il-sung was between the Soviet Union and China, although he was able to get very significant extractions or concessions from both Japan and the United States as well. So it seems to me, thinking about the historical context of the fact that both of these regimes are, after all, Korean, both of these men were products of 20th century Korean history, and even though North and South Korea have diverged so dramatically in the last few decades, it might be worth, I think, still exploring in more depth what we can learn about how political economies of this type can work and what kinds of alternative directions history can go in coming out of the same culture, the same background. The second thing I wanted to talk about, and I think we might have some interest in discussion of this later on, is Park Chung-hee and his legacy and his memory, the memory of Park Chung-hee, which has been in the last 15 years or so referred to not entirely positively as Park Chung-hee syndrome. Not to take anything away from the value of this book, in a way the project itself emerges out of this Park Chung-hee syndrome, which was at its full flower in the late 1990s, in the early 2000s. Now, by the time Park was assassinated in 1979, he was not a popular man, both within the inner circles of government and within South Korean society more broadly. It's clear, and the book brings this out, he had, in a way, gone too far in many of his policies and in his self-aggrandizing belief in his significance for Korea. This was already apparent, of course, in the Yushin Constitution in 1972. But like all dictators, and we certainly see many of them in various parts of the world today, Park came to believe he was indispensable for Korea, and he had no intention of stepping down, despite the fact that he had said several times since the beginning, since the early 1960s, that he would. So when Park was assassinated in 1979, there was a widespread expectation, and in many sectors of Korean society, a hope that Korea would follow a different course. It turned out not quite to be that way. But despite the fact that after this brief period of democratic opening in late 1979, Chun Doo-hwan staged his own coup, a kind of almost repeat, in a way, of what Park had done in 1961, Chun seemed to have wanted to distance himself from Park. He carried on much the same policies in the economy as Park, but he and his media that was controlled by the state, of course, at this time, tended to portray Park in a rather ambiguous, if not negative, light. And as the Chun Doo-hwan era progressed, the opposition, which had begun to emerge under Park, grew more powerful and more vociferous. Until finally, Chun was forced to step down from power after the massive protests of the summer of 1987. And Chun, it has to be said, was not terribly missed. There have been rehabilitations of Park Chung-hee's reputation and Lee Seung-man's, but it's hard to imagine Chun Doo-hwan's memory becoming too burnished anytime soon. I could be wrong about that. There's always more than one life in Korean politics. But certainly, Chun Doo-hwan was seen as someone who, in a sense, had continued on the practices of Chun Doo-hwan without the kinds of, without, as it were, the historical necessity of what Park Chung-hee had done to take South Korea from dire poverty into relative affluence and power. And with the democratization of the late 1980s, the whole authoritarian period from of Park and Chun tended to be lumped together in a very critical way. But by the mid-1990s, this began to shift under Kim Yong-sam, and the Park Chung-hee legacy began to be reevaluated in films, in popular media, TV shows, scholarly works. All kinds of proliferations of writings about Park came out and became enormously popular in the late 1990s. Indeed, in a poll taken by the government in 1997, Park Chung-hee was rated the most respected historical figure in all of Korean history, ahead of the great King Sejong and Admiral Lee Sun-shin, whom Park Chung-hee himself had elevated to this great historical icon while he was president. Now, what explains this explosive growth in the popularity of Park Chung-hee at this time? It's hard to say for sure, but there are a number of factors that might be involved. One is the post-democratization reevaluation of South Korea's political history and the kind of distancing of the society from this authoritarian period, which was no longer seen in this single light. Related to that was a disillusionment with the presidents of the post-democratization period, all of which, beginning with Noh Tae-woo, began with enormous popularity and ended being extremely unpopular, sometimes down in the single digits according to popularity polls. So there was a kind of nostalgia back for a time when there was a unifying leader, without the messiness and the complexity of divided popular opinion, at least being made public. There was also a generational change in South Korea of more and more people coming of age who didn't have strong memories of the Park Chung-hee period itself, and who saw the new affluence of Korea society being linked back to him and tended to wash over the negative aspects of his rule. And perhaps a need, again related to the disillusionment with the current political leadership, for a hero in 20th century Korea, of which there was rather a short supply. And Park Chung-hee, who was attributed to this great project of taking a war-ravaged, desperately poor Korea into the ranks of advanced industrial societies, at least beginning that process, was a likely candidate. This is not to say by any means that Park Chung-hee's memory is entirely positive. South Korean society remains deeply divided over the legacy of Park Chung-hee, although I think at the popular level, the view of Park is more positive than negative. Among the intellectual class, there is a very strong critical element who simply see Park as a dictator. Nevertheless, there are various contending views of Park's memory, in sort of intellectual and media circles, but also in popular culture as well, that will remain for some time. And if nothing else, I think it's fair to say that Park is the most complex and most interesting and most significant, whether we agree or support what he did or not, of any of the leaders that South Korea has had since the Republic was founded in 1948. The final question I want to ask is, when did the Park Chung-hee era end? This book is called The Park Chung-hee Era. Clearly it began 50 years ago in May 1961 with the military coup, but when does it end? It doesn't end, I think it's fair to say, with the death of Park Chung-hee in October 1979, because in many ways, as I've suggested, what his successor Chun Doo-hwan did was continue most of Park's legacy. Perhaps it ended with the democratization of 1987. That's one point. although I think it's more reasonable to say that the political legacy was more fundamentally transformed in 1992 with the coming to power of Kim Il-sung, or perhaps in 1998 with Kim Dae-jung's presidency. In the area of the economy, much of what Park Chung-hee put in place remains, but the type of big business government collusion that characterized the developmental state of Park Chung-hee has transformed quite dramatically since the late 1990s. Many of however, the legacies that Park Chung-hee can be attributed to still continue. And maybe we can conclude by saying we are still living in the Park Chung-hee era. Thank you. We'll take questions or comments.
We'd ask for recording purposes, please ask your question from the microphone here.
I wanted to respond to what you said about the comparison of the Korean business development in the Park era relative to Japan's development earlier, and the comparison of the Jaebol system and the Keiretsu Zaibatsu system, which a comparison has been made quite frequently. And a lot of people talk about, in the larger Asian context, the Iron Triangle, the collusion between big business, banks, and government, as frequently discussed, as a sort of nickname for this type of controlled economy with fast economic development based on banks doling out money when the government tells them to give it to so-and-so. And it's now 13 years after the Asian currency crisis, and when the IMF came into Korea, of course, there was a lot of finger-pointing and talking about how the Iron Triangle, the Jaebol system, the Korea's economic growth had been somehow a sham, let's say, and that that's why the economy tanked at the end of 97, beginning of 98. But if you really think about it in long-term historical perspective, Korea's economy has grown, 10,000% between 1960 and today. And if you compare what Korea and Japan did long-term since World War II economically to countries like Mexico or the Philippines you mentioned or Poland recently or you can think of a lot of similar populous nations with the potential to grow that did not. So my question then is there something about the Iron Triangle and the Jaebol Zaibatsu system that in fact works, that just takes leverage and uses it excessively, enthusiastically, but succeeds for countries like Japan and Korea? In your opinion?
Well, you want me to start?
Yes, Joe.
I think what Park Chung-hee did was to take the pre-war Zaibatsu system, which is something that he knew very well, and just as he was concerned with the pre-war Japanese military, where the Zaibatsu had very strong control over the developments and really dominated the economy. With the American occupation of Japan and the Zaibatsu busting, the Iron Triangle was never as tight in the post-war period as it had been in the 1930s, and it was much looser. I think there's no question that for certain periods of development, that all the Asian countries that have prospered have had very tight control. If you think of the American advice to the world, was we should get democratic. If you think the two great examples of democracy in Asia, probably the Philippines and India, and you say, have those countries been very successful, I think you'd have to say no. And it was precisely when Park Chung-hee didn't listen to American advice about developing a steel company and really pushing the economy so hard that really succeeded. One thing I could have stressed also is that both Deng and Park were people who really were very driven, and they wanted to go very fast. And they were overwhelming the people who wanted to have more balanced finance. So there's no question, I think, that it worked very well. One thing about the legacy, and Charles has raised very interesting questions about the legacy that's interests me, but compared Japan and Korea, is in many ways Korea has done much better than Japan the last, say, 15 years. And you ask why. I think for one thing that somehow strong leaders have had a bigger role in Korea, and you now have a very strong president. And for the last 10 to 15 years, Japan has changed leaders so often that they don't, not only they have weak leaders, but that the institutions in society can't plan for the next leadership. And if you take the private sector economy, one of the things that surprised me is that comparison of Toshiba Hitachi with Samsung. Mm-hmm. Samsung, what, 20 years or so ago, when the founder of Samsung passed away, wasn't that about 20 years ago, I think? Mm-hmm. That when he passed away, Lee Byung-chul, Toshiba was maybe 20 times as big as Samsung. Now, Samsung Electronics is larger than all the largest Japanese companies put together. Also, in terms of the response to the financial crisis, I think because Korea was in more trouble, it responded more vigorously. The Japanese banks have not responded as vigorously. I think that somehow that in Japanese companies and Japanese government, there hasn't been that strong centralized leadership to make tough and fast decisions. And somehow in South Korea, I think coming out of that period, you've really been much more successful in keeping up that rapid trend change and having strong leadership to make tough, difficult decisions. I think it's interesting to me that even somebody like Kim Dae-jung, who is advocate of democracy, was not exactly a weak leader. It was a strong, vigorous person. It's interesting to me that after the Park period, that the leaders have emerged in the democratic period have all been quite strong. Whereas in Japan, I think the political system, by not having elected president for a longer period of time, has had much weaker leadership.
Yes, I think that's true. I think part of the problem with Japan is structural. The way the government is set up, it makes it very difficult for a strong leader to emerge. I don't have much to add to that, except to say that, in the words of our former president, Korea has been consistently misunderestimated. End of the South Korean economic miracle has been predicted many times, but they keep going from strength to strength. And I think that has to do with a fundamental misunderstanding of the potential of Korea, and also the determination, and I think that's the right word to use, of the Koreans to make this work. One thing that seems to have been effective is Koreans' refusal to listen to a lot of outside advice. It's been said that one reason the South Korean economy was able to rebound as quickly as it did from the late 1990s Asian financial crisis is because it didn't listen to all of the advice of the IMF. But what I hadn't realized until reading this book is how long South Korea has not been listening to the advice of the IMF, because Park Jin-hee did a pretty good job with that too.
I have two questions. I'm Kim Hye-am from Cornell University Medical College. Two questions for each one of you, that one each you may answer. One is Park Jong-hee's relationship with the United States government. Certainly he was disliked by U.S. government, and Park Jong-hee at one time tried to develop an atomic bomb and so on. So there was a hairy moments between the two, and they didn't like him, but how much there was like a two Koreas, the book of two Koreas in Orphan Krantz, the book illustrate a lot of such conflicts, yet it's not clear what was the U.S. policy behind. The U.S. certainly supported a lot of dictators all around the world. So I'd like to know a little more about what the U.S. government's attitude about Park Jong-hee was. A second question is Park Jong-hee's relationship with the Korean intellectuals, especially the democracy movements and the popular, the people uprising, later students uprising. And what was he had in mind, Park Jong-hee had in mind, really, whether there was any kind of thinking of collaborate with the North Korea to suppress this kind of intellectual democracy movement to lead into kind of anti-American movement. Was there any such a possibility at the time? Thank you.
The first question, the attitude of the American government toward South Korea. I think because South Korea has such a strong Christian population that the Christian groups in the United States have played a very big role in shaping the American attitudes. And because a lot of the Christian groups were associated with intellectuals, I think, and more concerned with democracy, I think that is one of the things that led to the political support in the United States for the more democratic movements. And because the United States had leverage over South Korea and was giving so much money, I think there was a great desire to help promote democracy, particularly toward the latter part of the Cold War, when there were more Americans concerned that we'd been coddling too many dictators. But even though people felt that way, and certainly President Carter was an example when he was talking about pulling troops out of South Korea, I think there was a limit all during the Cold War as to how far that could go. And there were always strong people in the Pentagon and at the White House who said, we very much need South Korea. And so I think it was a very ambivalent, complicated attitude. And I think Park on the one hand, I think felt much more comfortable with Japanese than he did with the United States, and was certainly very unhappy with all the opposition in the United States to what he was doing and all the pressure to try to be more democratic. In the question of whether there was any opportunity, any possibility of North and South cooperating against intellectuals, as far as I can see, there was none. That the enmity between North and South Korea was so strong I think that Charles has pointed out, the intellectuals were very ambivalent. There were people who were cooperative, but certainly they were much more sympathetic to Park than they were to North Korea. Well, there was a small group of South Koreans, because they're so alienated from Park, were sympathetic to North Korea. There was a very distinct group. But I think the chance that the Park regime would cooperate with the North for intellectuals is, as I can see, was a non-starter.
Yes, indeed, one of the reasons for the Yushin move toward dictatorship was related to the reaching out to North Korea. Park wanted to make sure that interacting with North Korea would not encourage pro-North Korean sympathies in South Korea. So he wanted to keep, you know, possible pro-North Korean sympathies under control in the South by extending the state's surveillance and repression of any such criticism from emerging. There were at least two issues, as you point out, that caused friction between the U.S. There were many, but two rather outstanding ones in the 1970s. One was quiet. One was public. The quiet one was more or less South Korea's move to develop nuclear weapons capacity in the early 1970s. Which was put to a halt to under strong U.S. pressure. And the other was Jimmy Carter's call for troop withdrawal and promotion of human rights. And that was the point at which, I think it's fair to say, U.S.-South Korean relations were at their nadir just before Carter and just after Carter was elected. But things got back on track after that. I remember Richard Gleistein's memoir.
Bill
Gleistein's memoir, the ambassador to South Korea under Carter, how disastrous Carter's visit to South Korea was when he met with Park Chung-hee and lectured him about human rights, which Park did not like at all. But in fact, as we all know, Carter reversed his position on troop withdrawal, and the criticism of human rights, whether we agree with it or not, became muted after that.
Perhaps you can say a few words, we're focusing on President Park, about the motivations and way of thinking of the president. It always seemed to me when I lived in Korea during much of the 70s that Koreans in general had the idea that they wanted to get to their proper place in the world, and they still do, and why they're still progressing, and that they felt that in President Park had the same kinds of motivations, and so there was able to be, even though not everybody agreed with everything that was being done, there was a good ability for the government, the private civil society, private society, and so on to collaborate, so to keep moving the country up and up. Over time, I think actually you're right that in general, Korea went ahead by not paying so much attention to foreign advice, at least to a point. But I think over time they did, Korea did tend to heed one important piece of advice, which was that it became no longer necessary to out Japan, and that that Korea could move along in its own way. I'd be interested in your comments on how President Park, if you accept that thesis, how President Park might fit into that and how they got things working together. Just as a final comment, I think the word collusion has been used too much in these discussions, that there was collusion, but there was a lot more than that.
Mm-hmm. Well, we could call it cooperation, I guess.
Yeah.
Close cooperation. Park was clearly very interested in the Japanese model, even obsessed is I think not an unfair characterization. He had his ambassador to Japan send him every book he could find on the Meiji Restoration, because that's sort of what he saw as the touchstone for what he wanted to do in Korea. But I don't think there's much more to say about that. I think South Korea has largely gotten over at this point, out Japaning Japan, and has really charted its own course.
One of the things that impressed me about South Korea, compared to other countries in Asia, is that they're so cosmopolitan they've been so interested in what was going on in Japan, China, and the United States. And to me, one of the reasons for the success now is because they've sent so many people abroad and because they're so deeply embedded in the economy everywhere. In some ways, if I had to, you know, have a quick characterization of some difference between Koreans and Japanese, it's that Japanese are a little more introverted, a little more, you know, small island mentality than in Korea. And Koreans have really embraced, if you compare the number of students, say, from Korea in the United States and in China, they're now more than in Japan, with Japan, you know, roughly three times the population. Yeah. So I think it's really extraordinary, this cosmopolitan nature of the South Koreans and of going beyond Japan. Of course, Park Chung-hee was more Japan, but there were people, you know, dealing with the United States and China in a much more, a much deeper way, I think, than in Japan.
Mm. I want to say, when the book keeps referring to these two sort of phrases of Park Chung-hee, rich country, strong army, which comes from Japan, and can-do spirit, which, of course, is stereotypically American. It was those two together, and not just the Japanese model, but the Japanese model and the American influence that really came together in a very powerful way in Park Chung-hee's career.
I'm John Koch. I'm a researcher. I did my military service in Korea during the Park era, so this conversation is really generating memories. But I don't really have any memories other than the fact that, you know, Park Chung-hee was our ally, and it didn't go beyond that. But in terms of Park as a political leader, I think he's a man for all seasons. If you look at the elements of leadership and what he had to contend with, if you look at him relative to the competition, there have been nine Korean presidents since Syngman Rhee. He's the only one to have been assassinated, and assassination can be an elevating aspect of leadership. It's also an attempted assassination at the beginning, in terms of his relationship with Kim Il-sung, but then he turned it around and entered dialogue. So I think Koreans can take a lot of self-respect from the way he handled North-South relations. In terms of, I think he really has no peers in terms of cementing Korea's position as an economic powerhouse, and that is so bound up with the identity of South Korea on the world stage that it just reinforces his leadership. And finally, in terms of the way he handled the Americans, at the beginning of his rule, the Kennedy administration was preoccupied with how do we civilianize the Korean government. And then, as Professor Armstrong mentioned, at the end, during the Jimmy Carter period and even before with Kim Dae-jung's kidnapping, he had problems. But there was a period of time, more than a decade, when his rule was, his relationship with the Americans during the Vietnam era and so forth was, he played that to Korea's economic advantage, and also he was unchallenged politically by the Americans. I remember the Brown Memorandum, which basically said that we're not going to involve ourselves in the internal affairs of South Korea because South Korea is contributing to the effort in Vietnam. So I think on those four levels, his leadership was exemplary, and I think that you have to give him high marks anyway. That's my comment.
All I want to say is that Park Chung-hee's assassination prevented him from leaving office in disgrace, which was the case with his predecessor. So that, in a way, helps his legacy in a strange way, I think.
Fascinating talk so far. I have a few quick questions for you in regards to the Park Chung-hee era and sort of the lessons that countries in sub-Saharan Africa can draw from Park Chung-hee's style of leadership and his sort of deep belief that Korea could transform itself. that's something that I don't think a lot of African leaders have, because they're sort of at a point that they can transform their countries, but there's too many other things that are going on. Civil wars, IMF intervention, lack of institutions. And I was wondering if you could comment more on Park Chung-hee's leadership. Thank you.
So you're the completist.
I would go back to comparative colonialism, because, you know, what the Japanese argue is that their period of colonial Korea was much more development. I mean, they built the university, they built institutions, whereas I think a lot of the colonialism in Africa was not really developing. And I think the Koreans at the time of they broke away from the colonial Japanese colonial people, there are a lot of people who are already trained in technology and finance and economics, who are prepared, who had taken part in the modernizing effort in a way that was not true of colonialism in many of the African countries. So I think that explains a lot of the difference. Why the Koreans were more confident is because they had more experience and they knew how these systems worked. Then, of course, I think a strong military makes a big difference. And a military that has fought in big wars, it seems to me, makes a difference. One of the ways I could look at some of the Latin America, for example, the dictators and military leaders, is they haven't fought. People who fought wars and done so in a fairly large scale requires coordination, communication, discipline. I've been very interested in one of Deng's ways of going about things. He has political campaigns, but it can be called regrouping. That when he deals with problems, after a military campaign, you regroup for the next. You don't spend time moaning about what went wrong the last. The focus is not on giving blame to the past. The focus is on reorganizing for the next battle. And you don't waste time sort of blaming. You don't waste time with ideology. You're very practical. And so I think people who fought in big military campaigns over a period of time, they have to learn to deal in that kind of way. And I think that contributed to Park's leadership, and I think it contributed to Deng's leadership.
It should be remembered that in the 1970s, the more popular Korean model in much of sub-Saharan Africa was North Korea, not South Korea. North Korea seemed to be a great example of a country that had pursued an independent course of development, and this was something that the recently liberated states of sub-Saharan Africa thought was something that they could follow. And North Korea indeed had policies of trying to educate development, to bring its developmental model, or at least its Juche ideology, to a number of places in sub-Saharan Africa. And it wasn't until the 1980s that it began to be clear that the North Korean model wasn't working very well, and there was a turn to the south. I think it's very hard to replicate any such program anywhere else. And in some ways, the South Korean path has been unique. But if there's a large lesson to be taken from the Park Chung-hee era experiences, perhaps that a country to develop can, and if you compare it to North Korea, what Park did was neither go on a path of autarky nor completely relinquish control to the outside, but rather deal selectively with the outside world in order to develop the country's economy. And that's not easy to do, and that takes a certain kind of leadership that can't, I think, be easily replicated.
Hi. My name is Sangun Kim. I'm a graduate student studying Korean history at Columbia. And I wanted to ask a question regarding the meaning of reevaluating Park Chung-hee's era, especially in regards to, as a student studying Korean history, Koreans are often like to think of themselves as victim of history, being stuck in big powers around them geographically and et cetera. And it struck me when, Professor, you were talking about the uncompromised position of Deng Xiaoping versus Park Chung-hee as a compromised figure to start with, having to deal with the Japanese colonial legacy and the already preset kind of institutional setting in which he had to achieve or strive to achieve this economic success. And then my question is, in reevaluating the Park Chung-hee era, could you also say that this is an attempt at reevaluating how the Koreans think about their own history in a very victimized fashion, and what the implications of reevaluating this kind of way of thinking may be?
There's so many difficult, complicated issues. One is, it seems to me that the victimhood comes at a time when you're not very confident in yourself and you're not doing very well. And the Chinese also used victimhood terribly, and they go back to it again when they have problems with foreign countries. After 1989, after the Tiananmen incident, they talked about foreign sabotage and linking up with the local dissidents, and the problem was of foreign influence who were trying to mobilize actions and causing the difficulties. And they still go back to that occasionally. But I think that from the point of view of the South, and maybe Charles can talk about these things more, but in reevaluating their victimhood, I think they were victimized, and they were small. And in the case of Korea, they were caught between two larger powers, China and Japan, and they were, because Korea is so centrally located, the difficulties of 1895, 1904, 1905, Korean War, you look where the different powers meet and had their battles, it was Korea. So it seems to me that there's a lot of truth to the victimhood, and that maybe it's not reevaluating history, it's sort of seeing the new potential that came with Park Chung-hee. We can do something about it. We can do something about that past that was so full of victimhood.
Right. All I would like to say is that Park Chung-hee himself was very interested in getting Koreans out of their victim mentality. And he, much more than Syngman Rhee, strongly promoted kind of setting up hero figures in Korean history. He's the, under Park Chung-hee, these statues and monuments to East and Shin proliferated all around the country. The admiral who had defended Korea against the Japanese in the 1590s. And yes, I think the reevaluation of Park Chung-hee is partly something that goes back to Park Chung-hee himself in reevaluating Korean history, and Koreans begin to see the history not just under victimization, but one of success and of independence.
One of the points that interests me is who was behind Park Chung-hee at very critical points that helped him to do that kind of balancing that you were talking about, Charles, between excessive dependence on Weisei, and on the other hand, just giving the whole, or for, external forces or influences, or on the other hand, giving, you know, the country becoming too focused simply on oneself and not, you know, open to outside forces. And, you know, there are a whole series of people that come to mind that were absolutely critical. I mean, Nam Dak-woo, Kim Jae-ik, Han Byung-chung, who just happened to be my first visa sponsor in Korea. But, you know, Kim Jong-un, if we go beyond the economy to other fields. And, you can say it's, you know, Park deserves all the credit because he had the good sense to take advice and counsel from these people and to allow them to, direct policies. But, I don't know if Park would be seen as such a great leader if all of these, this great assemblage of people who were extraordinarily important and made extremely critical and, you know, retrospectively, you can say very correct decisions on the economy and politics and a lot of other areas. So I wonder what you think about that. I mean, because I think that in order to reevaluate the Park Chung-hee era, we really need to think about a whole panoply of top-notch people that you might say it's hard to find their parallels in the subsequent decades of Korean history.
Well, that's absolutely right. Park did not do all of this himself. and that's clearly expressed in this book in many of the chapters, which go into detail about who were making the decisions at many levels in the political system, the economy, and so forth. You know, this can't all be attributed to one man, but he was, you know, ultimately the person in charge. But I think, Ezra, you alluded to some factors that attributed to the generation that really came to power under Park, which made this possible.
I noticed that most of the names you mentioned were people with intellectuals and very talented people. I happen to have been very close to Kim Jong-un, who had studied at Harvard, and have enormous respect for him. And I think Korea was very lucky to have those very talented people who did their graduate training in one field or another abroad, or who knew Japan or the United States extremely well. But it was often difficult for them. I know Kim Jong-un talked to me about the problems of whether intellectuals would accept him for working with the enemy and working with that kind of dictatorial military. And it was a very difficult job for somebody who was an intellectual to serve very close to that power. And that was really a very tough time. But in addition to those you mentioned, I think you'd have to say that Kim Jong-pil and people like that also played a very, very big role. And it's rather remarkable to me how many of the military who were in the 8th class or at the Korean Military Academy who ended up having quite distinguished careers and who adapted quite well. It was the same thing in the Chinese Army. I mean, people like Chen Yi, who became foreign minister, very distinguished role. And I think it's really quite remarkable how many of those military people, in addition to the intellectuals that we all love and speak so highly of, also played a very constructive role.
I just wanted to add one brief word, having known most of the economic guys that that were mentioned. But I think while it's true that the president had to take advice and so on, it was always my impression that he was the one who really put the force there. I said to Kim Jong-un one time, who claimed he was going to tell the president, that the president had a form of blowtorch management. Basically, he came over to the Economic Planning Board once a month and for the report and so on and so forth. And, you know, nobody wanted to go in front of him without having accomplished what they were supposed to have accomplished in the previous month. And you had a whole country of that. It wasn't just at the presidential level, but all kinds of people who didn't want to come back to report not having succeeded in what they were supposed to do.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. That brings us to a close, and please help me in thanking Professor Ezra Vogel, Professor Charles Armstrong, and at a distance, Professor Kim Jong-kook. Thank you so much, and we do have the book out front. Please join us in back for wine and refreshments. Hope to see you at our next program.
The opinions expressed in the preceding program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Korea Society, its staff, management, or sponsors. Thank you for listening to this Korea Society podcast. If you enjoyed it, please consider becoming a member. Visit www.koreasociety.org for information about memberships and to learn more about all the programs available at the Korea Society.